since it seemed like it's going to be a long, cold winter without any prospects of holiday travel, figured I'd have some time on my hands, so I ordered Joan's Stambaugh's translation of Heidegger's Being in Time and Hubert Dreyfus's commentary on that text called Being in the World. Some of you will know the translator, Joan Stambaugh, because she's also written a wonderful book on Dogen called Impermanence is Buddha Nature. And when you think of it, those two terms, impermanence and Buddha nature, stand in sort of a analogous relation to being in time in Heidegger. And I thought I would just try to address a few basic things in being in time that might have some relevance to our Zen practice. One of the first points she makes as a translator is the decision not to capitalize the word being in the text. In German, nouns are routinely capitalized. And so in a way, to have a capital B being in German is no big deal. But as soon as you capitalize being in English, you've done something that's not so innocuous. We immediately hear connotations of either a supreme being, or we get some idea of abstract being in some transcendent way that is beyond or behind our ordinary life. And we get the idea that philosophy or our practice is supposed to get us in touch with this somewhat supernatural something, right? But one of the few short sentences Heidegger writes at the beginning of Being in Time is where he says, being is always the being of a being. That the only place being, this supposed abstraction, is to be found is in the being or nature of individual beings. It's not a separate entity or category above or beyond our life, but it's something that is a characteristic of the life we're already living. But his particular concern is human being. What is particular about human being? And he comes up with a very interesting definition, I think, because he says human beings are beings for whom their nature is itself a question. Human beings are beings for whom human being is itself problematic. And what that means is that we don't have any immediately definable essential nature of what it means to be a human being. You know, there's no equivalent to fish swim and birds fly. Human beings do what, right? There's no obvious or natural way to fill in the blank. Rather, for human beings, filling in that blank is the problem that makes them human. Trying to live a life where you've got to figure out what it means to live a life is what is particular to human beings. Now, various philosophies and religions, different times, have tried not to leave that blank open-ended. See, I think it's one of the crucial things in Heidegger, the existentialists, that they wanted to leave that blank open. A human being is blank, and they don't want to fill in with a simple, essential answer. But many people have ventured to do so, and it's sort of a typical kind of essential answer is that human beings are rational animals. Right? That our rationality is what makes us distinctly human. We think. And someone like Descartes, who wants to find the foundations of philosophy, you know, says that he can doubt everything about who he is and what the world is, except for the fact that he's sitting there thinking and asking this question. And so he can begin with a statement, I think, I think, therefore I am. But Heidegger, in effect, wants to turn that around and say, I am, therefore I think, among lots of other things, right? And that the thinking is not the essential or unique or distinctive quality. Someone like Immanuel Kant, in trying to devise a universal foundation for ethics, wants to say that he'll come up with an ethics that any rational person at any time and any culture, just because they're rational, will have to accede to. He wants to make that rationality a kind of universal, timeless quality. And says, once we all see that we share that quality, all these kinds of ethical implications will follow. But then you get a person like Nietzsche who comes along and says, you know, I'd much rather be Achilles than Socrates. I just prefer the life of a hero to the life of a philosopher. I'd like to define the highest virtue as courage, not rationality. Is there a rational argument against that choice? Is there some place you can neutral, is there a neutral place to stand to argue about why the life of Socrates is better than the life of Achilles? See, it turns out it's only from the perspective of a Socrates that you could do that. There's no argument that Achilles will agree to that disqualifies the preference for that kind of life. So Nietzsche is a kind of philosopher who tries to escape this essentializing argument. He just won't go along with the program, you know, that says man is essentially rational, right? He wants to say, no, I'm going to put in some other candidates for what man is. He's trying to, you know, make this move to leave the question open. Now, how do we approach this in Zen? I think it's interesting because there are a number of different responses to that in our Zen practice. But there's clearly a whole strand of thought or tendency perhaps you can associate it with the Taoist influence on Chinese Buddhism to say that Zen is an attempt to get us back in touch with what's natural, what's simple and basic about being human. And there you get the kind of the Zen of chop wood and carry water, right? You have the Zen of being in harmony with nature, right? As if being in harmony with nature had a self-evident content, right? But here there's a strong wish to discover within our practice, this simple, natural way of being human. In that way of thinking, the whole problematic that Heidegger wants to raise, that the idea that to be human is to engage with this unanswerable, open problem of what it means to be human. A certain strand of Zen would just say, only a neurotic intellectual European would come up with that kind of question for themselves. Being natural, being in harmony with nature, living this simple life, chopping wood, planting trees, planting your vegetables in the garden, sitting a little zazen in the morning and the evening. What could be more obvious, more simple, and more naturally human, right? And I think that it's probably important to recognize that we all have a kind of strong basic pull or longing, really, to find that kind of solution to the question. And that there's a whole strand of our practice that if we don't want to necessarily say colludes with that, at least offers that as a kind of simply available answer. And if we take that to be an answer, then we probably will end up feeling like this modern life that we're leading, going to work, living in cities, being intellectuals, doing all these complicated things that we do, are one way or another alienations from the simple natural life that is out there for somebody, right? And this can lead to a certain kind of fantasy or idealization of monasticism, which once in a while will present itself as a kind of return to natural simplicity. Now, actual institutional monasticism may or may not feel like that kind of simple life. As it actually is lived, it might feel a lot more like a highly regimented, highly ritualized, quite arbitrary form of life that is structured by an enormous number of culturally determined and arbitrary set of rules. And it might feel more like being an Orthodox Jew and having 600, you know, kinds of rules of what it means to keep kosher and follow the halakha than it does to being simply chopping wood and carrying water. But, you know, it has a lot of appeal. You probably, you know, if you become a monk, you don't have to worry about what you're going to wear in the morning or how you're going to fix your hair. And you don't have to worry about what you're going to do in the day because you just look at the schedule on the wall and it's all taken care of. So this has certainly at least the superficial appeal to the idea that there's a simple, natural answer to what does it mean to be human. But there is another side of Zen that I think does tend to keep the fill in the blank there wide open. And that's a side where it seems that these enlightened old masters are breaking out of all sorts of ordinarily given categories, at least categories of common sense and ordinary ways of talking. They do all sorts of wild and crazy looking stuff. And they say all sorts of things that on the surface don't make a lot of sense, right? You try to ask them a simple question and they hit you upside the head. Or they say something that doesn't sound like an answer at all. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to the West? 3 pounds of flax, right? So you get a whole dimension of Buddhism that says, don't think that who you are or what this life is can be bounded certainly by rationality, right? And there's also a strong tendency to say, don't think it can be bounded by your usual class and cultural norms or expectations. You get at least occasionally stories of a Zen teacher being rude even to the emperor, if not venturing to slap the emperor, but at least not behaving in the expected ways that someone would respond to status and authority and power. So in that side, there's this powerful antinomian, anti-established, anti-establishment, anti-rational behavior associated with Zen. To some extent, that got exaggerated and caricatured in what got called Beat Zen in the 50s and 60s by somebody like Alan Watts. But there's no question that that side of Zen was an enormous part of its appeal to my generation growing up in the 60s, where Zen looked positively countercultural, right? It became hard for those countercultural types to come to terms with the discipline and rigor and formalities of Japanese culture if they actually encountered a life in a Zen monastery or a Japanese teacher. But it certainly was a powerful dimension of what we thought Zen was and what attracted us to Zen. And now, as we practice today, I think that we have to try to examine our own particular answers to what we think Zen's answer to that question of what does it mean to be human? Is it simply Dogen's answer to sit Zazen is to experience the awakened way? Do we feel that monasticism is the closest thing humanly possible to a natural state of being in harmony with our nature and the nature of the world? Does Zen suggest an open-ended answer to the question where any form of life whatsoever that recognizes the reality of impermanence and interdependence is a Zen life? Does that take any particular form? Is it a monk? Is it a doctor? Is it an artist? Is it somebody who just goes to work every day, working in an office, but recognizes the finitude of their life and their own vulnerability and their dependence on others and others' dependence on them? Does Zen have anything to do with a particular form of life at all? How do you answer that question?